This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 25 for Thursday, September 17th, 2009. Introductus Interruptus. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours Greenwich Mean Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Music Store. Here we are, another episode of AutoLine After Hours. Welcome everybody joining us tonight, and welcome to Mr. Auto Extremist himself, Peter DeLorenzo, joining us here on Thursday nights as always.
Good evening, John. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good, and David Welch from Business Week. David, great having you here too.
Thanks, John. Good to be here.
I like being back in the saddle here. I was out last week in Phoenix, and you guys did a pretty good job in my absence.
Yes, we sat around the campfire and told stories, and it was good.
Hey, we have to remind everybody again, if you want to join us on Monday, we're doing a live webcast with Tom Stevens, who is the head of all product development at General Motors right now. In fact, we're going to do a live taping of AutoLine Detroit. And when we finish up with that, then we're going to just continue on as a live webcast. So if you'd like to send in questions to Tom Stevens at GM, give us a call on our line. We're at 1-620-288-6546. And I'll say that again, 620-288-6546. But enough of that. Let's talk about what's going on this week. And to me, the big news was the Frankfurt Auto Show. And it was a whale of a show. But, you know, somebody wrote into us that I think is a good question that ties in with your column this week that also ties in with the Frankfurt show. So Asian Martin sent in a comment sort of question that says, hey, we all know manufacturers voluntarily leak info before they get to the auto shows, with early reveals spewing left and right on the web that pretty much get rid of any sort of surprise. I'm paraphrasing what he wrote here. Why do it? Why not just kill all these leaks, all these embargoes, don't do anything until the auto show itself, and then just, boom, hit with a major impact?
I've been campaigning for that for years now. But, you know, you can't get a manufacturer to be that tight-lipped. They want to control things. They want to control the spin. And, yeah, I think the ultimate – think about the memorable auto shows we've seen in the last few years. Remember the Viper was introduced with no fanfare whatsoever, no buzz, no nothing. Lutz just came out. Here it was. It was just like, holy shit, what – you know. And then, you know, Wolfgang rode out on the Tomahawk.
That motorcycle.
Which I knew about. And we remember we talked, and I said, yeah, Wolfgang, you're not going to be ready for this. And, you know, they can do it if they wanted to, but they just can't help themselves. What were you going to say, Dan?
Well, there is one practical matter here for journalists, and that is, even if you have a big team, and you know, it's only been two or three of us at Business Week for a long time, but when I was at the Detroit News and we had a big auto team and a bunch of people on the show floor, even with, you know, five, six people, you have so many press conferences going on, so many product reveals, it's really tough to cover everything that's there, you know, running one-on-one interview with this executive to press conference to interview to press conference. And if you see this stuff beforehand, it's on an embargoed basis, and you can pretty much have a lot of the, you know, just the product reveals in the can. You know, as a news writer, I always like that because, you know, I can write about the new vehicles, have those stories ready to go after the press. You know, you go to the press conference to make sure they actually show the car and that it doesn't stall out or something embarrassing doesn't happen, which has happened. And then you go to the interviews and you try to get some real, you know, analysis or some breaking news out of these guys. And, you know, so that's sort of the practical side.
Yeah, I understand, but I think the surprise has literally been
eradicated.
Well, not only that, I've been at auto shows where, you know, they're pulling the wraps off something, and I'm going, hey, I already wrote about that. I'm out of here. I'm going to go look at something else.
And as a journalist, while it is good to have some of this stuff in the can, it's about as exciting as covering, like, the Democratic or Republican conventions. You know, it's all canned speeches. Everyone's on message. You know, it's, you know, what's going to happen. That there really isn't a lot of suspense. I mean, you know, if I were the car makers, they often have, say, two or three cars they're going to show. You know, two of them that are really important, maybe you showcase that stuff and you save one thing that nobody knows about except a handful of people, and that's going to be their big surprise pop just to, you know, kind of add some excitement to the whole thing. There's no reason they can't do that kind of thing.
Well, we saw that at the Detroit show to a mild degree when Cadillac brought out that horribly named the Converge. Bad name.
Really beautiful car.
Beautiful car. You know,
they wouldn't name it that if they built them.
No. But, I mean, yeah, that was kind of a surprise. The CTS Coupe was a surprise a couple years ago. It's just better. I really believe it. I think
it makes the auto show better.
Yeah.
Now, I understand, I think, why they leak so much information ahead of time and photos and all that is because so many publications, and I'm sure you guys did this at the Detroit News, is you do a pre-show edition so that everybody can read about what's coming up at the auto show. Pardon?
We do curtain raisers the way we've always done it at Business Week is we do a curtain raiser on the significant cars from the show on the website, you know, try to get it as early as we can before the show press day start. And then the press day starts on Sunday and everyone starts writing stories. Our issue hits the newsstand Friday. We always have a story that it's not about the entire show, but we pick one thing we know that's coming and sort of write about that or the subject, you know, if it's someone's new hybrid or whatever, maybe the subject is green cars or something, you know, and we do a magazine story. So we've always got our pre-coverage as well. And that's, you know, that's another good thing about some of these previews is, you know, but there's a better way for them to do it. You know, you have some of the stuff that's sort of let out beforehand to kind of build hype for the show. Then you have the canned stories that, you know, so we actually have an opportunity to cover everything. And then there should be some surprises in there.
No, well, you know, I talked about another thing I talked about with sort of the fading of car magazines because of the internet is to abandon the multiple, the info reveal dates. You know, we were just talking about but just say, okay, no, all the car magazines have websites now. So there's one, you know, there's one embargo date for everybody. There's no long lead just because you're a car magazine. No, because you've got a website now. So that's all. That should all be just eradicated, and you just have one date. But, boy, it's not happening.
It's probably not going to happen, but I think they hurt themselves. In fact, it'd be interesting to see if one automaker just held back one year and kabam, came out with great stuff at the show.
Honda usually doesn't do a reveal. Honda usually doesn't do a pre-reveal. You know, usually it's a surprise. Now, sometimes at their holiday party at the Rattlesnake Club, they've shown some stuff, but there's usually something else they show that they don't show there. I mean, usually you might know what it is,
right?
But you haven't seen anything about it, and they won't tell you. Honda's the best one at
it. No, I would agree with you. They are the best at that. But, you know, typically their cars are, you know, well-made, sell good,
well,
but pretty,
I was thinking that myself.
Pretty, you know, white bread, you know.
And you're like, yeah, it's an Accord.
Yeah, it's a new Pilot. So what? I mean,
okay.
And I don't mean to put it down. Yeah, it's just that at an auto show, you know.
Yeah, everybody's looking at their watch and seeing what's next on the schedule.
Yeah, where's the exciting stuff?
That's a good point, though. I mean, you know, people have been sort of slagging on Toyota for a while now, if for no other reason, but people were tired of writing good things about Toyota. But the average age of their buyers for Scion, Toyota and Lexus have been going up. You know, they've tried to inject some passion into the Lexus brand with sportier IS 250s and 350s and a sportier GS. And, you know, they've tried to amp up styling. I think the Venza is a pretty good-looking car. Some people don't, but they're trying to amp up styling. But yet, still not a lot of excitement there. But what do you say about Honda? I mean, I think Toyota's actually stepped out in design more than Honda has.
Oh, yes.
With the exception of the Civic. Honda's got a beloved, high-quality, high-tech, bland product line. I mean, their stuff, I have tremendous respect for their products and the company and their engineering. Yet, other than maybe a Civic Si, there's nothing that lineup I would buy. And Acura is even worse.
Yeah. Styling is not what they're known for. It's not that their styling is terrible. It's just
It's tasteful but boring. I mean, right. It's actually I can't say that the cars are all boring because there are interesting elements to the Accord, for example. But I mean, the sort of cars that they're better looking than many, but not as good looking as two or three others in the segment. So I'm never going to really go take a look.
You know, I think they did a good job on the new Fit.
Yeah, Fit's a good car. I'll give you that. Sure.
Look, when you get to the Fit and the Civic, that's when Honda's brilliant. When you start getting bigger than small cars, they're just not as good at that.
And that new sort of...
The weirdo thing, the Cross Tour.
Oh, I don't even want to talk about that. That's just a nightmare. But the new little CZX, the hybrid sports car coming.
Right.
I thought that was really nice. Mm-hmm. And I hope
again, very small car. Yeah. That's what they excel at.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
What'd you guys make of all the electric cars coming out at Frankfurt? And I ask it from this standpoint. To me, what was so telling is that the German industry, which has put more into developing clean diesels than everybody, you didn't hear boo about diesel at this show. It was all electric.
Yeah.
All of it was electric. It wasn't even hybrid. It was electric.
Yeah, it was quite a dramatic turn. I mean, you know, Peugeot and Renault in particular, they just went ape.
Yeah.
And then Audi showed that R8.
Electric.
Electric.
Which, it didn't work for me.
Whatever. Like, four individual electric motors. That's, well, I tell you, the high-performance electric vehicle, that's yet to be.
Well, the only thing about the Audi electric, the R8 electric, what'd they say? Over 3,000 foot-pounds of torque?
Yeah.
I was like, oh, my God. But the only other thing then was the performance figure we saw was 0 to 60 in 4.8 seconds. Well, listen here. If you got over 3,000 foot-pounds of torque, it should be like 0.8 seconds.
Yeah, you'd be melting the tires.
I was going to say, it is only 4.8 because they've burned off the rubber and it's running on the rims.
But
you bring up a good point. I think there's a lot of necessity here. I mean, in Europe, diesels are great. It's a great way to meet the regulations there. In the U.S. and other markets, not so much, and they've got to get it to electric drive.
Yeah, but if the diesel meisters themselves are saying, hey, look at all the electric stuff we have, is this the end of the diesel?
I don't think so. I just felt that they decided they had to be there. You know, political pressure, the government, they just had to be there. They couldn't be shown up by, of all things, the American car companies or, heaven forbid, the French, you know. but they kind of were because Renault had that just, you know.
Four different electric cars.
Yeah.
And,
I mean,
a
couple of them were like, you know.
Well, how many of them are real, though? I mean, how many of them are
I think one of them must be.
Well, the Kangoo is probably real because the Kangoo is an existing vehicle, and they're putting some batteries and electric motors in it.
But how many of them are going to be production cars? I mean, you know, that's.
Well, we know that Nissan's going whole hog into EVs.
No question, right.
And Renault's chair or CEO is the same guy, Carlos Ghosn.
I'm talking about the Germans.
Oh, that's a good question.
Now, Daimler's got the deal with Tesla.
Well, Mercedes showed that S-Class with, you know, the plug-in hybrid S-Class. You know, I don't know. I still think electric is just part of the solution, and it's just not going to be this. We aren't going to be all driving electric cars in 20 years. It's just not going to happen.
I would agree with you because electrics are only going to be able to be used for a very small niche of people. We keep talking about this. Where are you going to plug in?
Yeah.
I mean, I was talking to somebody outside this week, and I said, just look at right here. Where would I plug in here at work?
Extension cord?
I'm going to run an extension cord out when it's in the rain or the snow. It's like, no, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So you've got to have the charging capability that's very convenient.
Either that or you've got to have range that's over 300 miles so that you can always charge up at home.
Selective utilization, selective application.
Look, I mean, and that doesn't even get into issues of cost. We haven't really tested these as far as warranty. I mean, what do we really have on the road in terms of pure electrics? You got some Tesla Roadsters that are, you know, let's face it, because they are Roadsters.
They're kit cars.
Yeah. They are mostly sold in nice climates or by people using them as weekend toys. you know, we really haven't had an electric on the road that's used every day, day in, day out, getting beat on the way, you know, we beat on our other cars in all kinds of weather and potholes and you name it.
I mean, you're hearing stories of GM developing the Volt, and that's the first, really, the first, you know, electric car to go through all the production, R&D development, the production sequences, you know, the cold and hot testing. You know, it's the first one really going through the classic development process. Because Tesla's, you're right, it's a kit car, but this one, we'll see.
I mean, well, I think they're going to do just fine, because look at how robust hybrids have turned out to be, especially the batteries. And that really shocked me, and I'm not the only one shocked by it. There, for all practical purposes, have not been problems with the batteries. These things,
except they aren't using the new batteries, right? They're not.
They're using nickel metal hydride.
Yeah,
no, you're absolutely right. But if you go back a dozen years or so ago, when the first Prius came out, that was the bleeding edge, and nobody knew if nickel metal was really going to work.
You know, I don't think it's going to be this catastrophe where you've got, like you had with Sony laptops, batteries catching on fire and that sort of thing.
No, I'm
it's more a matter of durability.
It's durability over, you know.
Sure, but an electric car is far simpler than an internal combustion car, or certainly more simple than a hybrid or a plug-in.
Look how often you see, you know, somebody recalling 1.3 million vehicles because of something that the industry's been making for 100 years breaks down. I mean, you know, you're going to have to be on that curve. More to the point, for me, with batteries and electric drive, is not just durability, but you know, temperature and all these conditions we're talking about affect range, and you know, that's going to be a big issue for people.
One interesting thing, I did an interview with a woman from AeroVironment, very advanced technology company that I don't want to get sidetracked on, but we've got that interview on the John's Journal section of our website. They've developed a charger that goes directly into the battery of the car. Because right now, if you plug in an electric car, you have AC coming out of your home or place of business. It goes into the onboard charger, which converts it to DC, which goes into the battery. That converter is like a choke point. So they've got a charger that goes direct DC into the battery, and you can, she claims, charge up a battery that will get most people through most of their day in about 10 minutes' time. And the idea is to put these in gas stations. So it's just like a gas station. You see the needle getting low on the gauge, you roll in there, 10 minutes later, you've got another, I don't know, 20, 25 miles worth of range, which, you know, if you use an electric for which you're going to have to use it, i.e. not driving across the country but making little runs, that could be kind of cool. Now all of a sudden your range anxiety is gone.
Yeah, cost is still a huge factor, though.
But that's the big thing, absolutely.
I mean, the other problem, I mean, look, there, even when you have a good lithium-ion battery pack, there's just not that much power on board, and that's the problem we're talking about here. So you have this tremendous cost here for a relatively small amount of power, and you know, that's really the problem right there. It's not just the cost of the battery, but the lack of power density. And if you look at the improvements in battery, I can't remember who I was talking to about this just a couple days ago, but we've seen some pretty good improvements in lithium-ion battery cost over the past couple of years, the cost coming down. Power density hasn't improved much.
Right. And, you know, that's why Gowen came out during the Frankfurt show and said EVs only make sense as long as oil's over $70 a barrel, which it is right now.
I think it's even more. It's got to be even more than that.
Right. Well, then he went on to say, if it's over $200 a barrel, it's no problem. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, no kidding, man.
I think he's wrong about 70. I mean, oil's been 65 to like 80 for a while now, and we're not even really selling that many hybrids at the moment.
Well, you're right. But that's why Lutz came out and said it's got to be $5 to $6 a gallon.
Yes,
for EVs, right. You know, where people go, yeah, this is a no-brainer. Give me an EV.
I don't know where Gowen comes off saying he's in Europe where, you know, forget about the cost of oil because they have such heavy taxes, you know, and they're not selling. There are many, you know, EVs on the market, obviously, but, you know, there's not a huge outcry for them. Or for hybrids because they've got diesel and gasoline's already expensive.
Carlos has made a huge bet on this. I mean, a huge bet.
Bet the farm, yeah. Almost kind of bet. They've poured a scary, between them and Renault,
Yes. They've
poured, what did he say, $4 billion? Was that right? That's a huge bet.
Yeah, because that's, you know, GM spent $5 billion resurrecting Cadillac. That's a huge bet. And he's talking about building a lot of these vehicles.
I mean, what are they putting in the capacity? 350,000 a year? Yowza.
And that's by, what, 2013 or 14 they want to be able
well,
to
he's saying by 2020, 20% of all vehicles worldwide will be electric. And I'm with Peter on this one totally.
I think we better get Simon Sproul on the line and talk to him.
Yeah.
You know, he's working back with Carlos again.
In Paris.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we need some splain in there. And the other thing that I thought was very telling this week, Toyota came out and said, we're sticking with nickel metal hydride batteries in our hybrids.
Well, I'll tell you, the biggest announcement from Toyota this week is they are going to spend $1 billion in marketing for the fourth quarter. And let me just tell you.
In the U.S.
In the U.S., that is absolutely staggering.
Yes, it is.
It is staggering.
Now, let's put this in perspective, because I want to say the total ad spend for automakers is about $10 billion a year.
I think it's
more than that.
Is it? No, I'm just talking automakers. I'm not talking the dealers or dealer associations.
GM spent over $2 billion.
Yeah. It was $2 plus billion. Now, it was, before they cut. You know,
yeah, GM was up to 2.4 before the cutback.
Okay. Okay, so here, just think about that. Before the cutback, before they got religion, $2.4 billion, and now Toyota's going to spend $1 billion in or 3 months.
Akio Toyota, just talk about betting the farm. He said, we need to get our mojo back and make noise, and it's just,
well,
people aren't ready for what this really means. It's going to be all Toyota all the time on the airwaves.
Something's going on a bit here because Business Week's for sale, right? And, you know, we have some private equity players bidding on it. And I've had everyone ask me, well, what does private equity want with this? And frankly, I don't know, because I was talking to a guy at Ripplewood, and, you know, they had quite a disaster with Reader's Digest. And I forget, another private equity player had a tough time with TV Guide. And this guy was telling me, I don't know what we want with this thing. But because you've got three private equity firms bidding on Business Week. The Boston Globe is in play, and, you know, you've got other papers that are owned by private equity now, and what do they want with them? It's print, it's dead, and this sort of thing. But you think about it, what do they want to do? They want to buy assets cheap, and you've got GM with this big ad push, and they're spending more. Now, they're doing it because they have to right now, but they're doing it. Toyota coming out and saying this. Look, we've had some thin issues at Business Week, and, we had more than, which is good for us, lately, more than 80 pages in the current issue, and it's going to be much fatter in the next issue. Ads have started to come back a bit. I think what's happening with these private equity players is they're figuring this is the bottom of the market. If the economy is truly bottoming out, any company selling anything that has some money is going to say, okay, now is time to start advertising while some of our competitors are still reeling. So that way, when things start to pick up, you know, we can take advantage. And I think that's what Toyota's doing. I think they're thinking that the economy has hit bottom. And even if it's not showing signs of picking up yet, they want to be the guys who are in everybody's front of everybody's mind when people start to buy cars again.
But, Peter, do you get to the point where, I mean, if you spend $1.25 billion, I mean, every time I pick up the paper, every time I look at a billboard, every time I turn on the radio, every time I turn on the TV, all I hear is Toyota, 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 it's not going to take long for my brain just to switch it right off.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they might be overdoing it by a bunch. To your point, GM jumped in with the hangover of cash for clunkers to launch this big ads campaign.
Well, and they're not, you know, people keep asking, you know, where are the results of GM? They've been out of bankruptcy for about 2 months, you know. So now is the time.
Now they're out of inventory, so yeah.
So now is the time where they have to start, you know, working on the cultural issues inside the company, and they have to start working on the perception problem out in the public. So, you know, that's why they're spending right now, but they are spending more, and Toyota's pushing. I think you're going to see other car makers do it as well. I mean, you know, if they're all kind of gambling that.
Yeah, but I will tell you, no car company is going to match Toyota. As $1 billion in the fourth quarter. Not even close.
They couldn't match it before. You know, all these Saturn dealers in Southern California who were tasked by GM with, you know, reaching out to import owners, would tell me, we can't do it because, we're just outshouted, 20-1 against Honda and Toyota in this market. You know, he said, forget about GM's ad budget being smaller than Toyota's. Well, let's think about Saturn's tiny budget within that. And, you know, Toyota, their marketing isn't necessarily splashy, but it's usually, you know, those new Prius ads are pretty creative.
They're very eye-catching.
And just overall, the one thing about Toyota's marketing and advertising that's very good, it's consistent.
Well, you know, the Prius ads, you know, I made fun of them, it's the ultimate shiny, happy people thing. But the music is, like, strangely hypnotic. It's just like getting, it's like you hear it after a while, it's just like I'm feeling kind of green, something's taking over my body. So who knows what they're going to do with all this money. I mean,
Is GM actually increasing its ad budget, or is it just that the four surviving brands now get the money that were spent on the brands that are getting cut?
Well, I think they've caught, first of all, they're trying to come back to where they were before the debacle, which they aren't there yet. Then they're focusing the money on the four divisions. So where that adds up together, maybe it's right back to where they were at one point.
See, that's my guess.
But focused on their
right.
The metric they gave us, and it was one of these metrics that says they're spending a lot of money. You know,
I don't believe their metrics, by the way.
Well, it's one of these things where they sort of ask you to close one eye and cover one ear and come to the conclusion that they're spending a lot. But I'm kind of being facetious a bit here, but what Lutz was saying was that I think it was as a percentage of their market share, their share of voice is higher than it's ever been. Now, their market share is down. I think the bottom line is, like you said before, they're not getting up to, you know, a rate of $2.4 billion a year or whatever it was where they used to be, but they're spending a lot more because, you know, as they not even during the bankruptcy.
They went dark.
They, you know, and we're talking, you know, going probably to late last year, they started pulling back.
Sure, they ran out of money.
Yeah. And they were cutting way back. I mean, you know, they did just about go dark. So they're sort of, I think, marching their way back up. You know, I talked to Mark LaNave, you know, their head of sales, who was then also head of marketing, during the bankruptcy, and he said that, you know, once they get back to normal spend, they were talking about a Cadillac budget that was going to be like $300 million a year when it used to be about $200 million. And I forget what Chevy was. I mean, but Chevy was another one that was going to get a, you know, a really big increase just because they were getting rid of.
Well, Chevy at one point, I mean, it was $800 million. It's a lot.
I had the numbers.
Which, again, puts the Toyota number in perspective. Yeah. Here's Chevrolet spending $800 million, and Toyota's going to spend $1 billion in 3 months.
Chevy was between $600 and $800 in the heyday.
I think they told me they were going to get close to $1 billion.
Yeah. But in the fourth quarter, I mean, that's just for your listeners and watchers out there, get ready because it's going to be an onslaught.
Hey, go back to the Frankfurt Auto Show. Peter, styling-wise or product-wise, you know, forget the EV stuff for the moment. What else stood out in your mind?
Well, I mean, the 458 Italia. I mean, what can you say?
Ferrari.
It's just fabulous. I mean, spectacular. The Bugatti that you like.
Galibier, I think is how it's pronounced. Stunning car because
The sedan.
The sedan. Well, it's got these highly mirrored sides to it.
Aluminum. Yeah, it's just polished aluminum. It's just fabulous. I liked the Peugeot, and I don't know the designation of it. It was three initials, C something. I thought it was
the inky dinky little car.
No, it was
okay. They had an inky dinky one called the BB1.
Which
was kind of interesting. It was a nice design statement.
Yeah, funky. This Peugeot was just a nicely rendered coupe, and then the Renault stuff. I think Ben told me you liked which one of the Renaults.
Well, there was one called the Zoe.
Yeah,
electric car.
I thought the Zoe was pretty cool.
Yeah,
pretty cool. And Porsche showed this 911, which I forgot to tell Ben about, called the Classic, this package that we won't get here, and it was gorgeous, really.
Is this the Renault?
That's the Renault Zoe that's up on the screen right now, right?
Yeah, I thought that was very cool.
And, yeah.
What did you like?
Same thing. I loved that Bugatti Galibier, just a stunning styling statement. I like the Renault Zoe, which we had up there. And I'm intrigued by this one. Oh, here's the Bugatti.
Yeah.
I mean, that is just.
It's just.
I have arrived, is what it says.
But you know what? It's I mean, it sort of has the you know, Bentley kind of thing, actually sort of more than that going on, but it's a unique statement, too, and that's a stunning.
There was an expression I was exposed to when I...
Eva Italia.
Yeah.
when I moved to New York to work on Madison Avenue, the agency I was working for, there was a takeover buyout of it. And this one guy came up to me, because a lot of the people had been there made a lot of money one day. And this guy came in, he said, you know, some of the guys were giving him a little grief. And so he said, "You're going to retire?" He said, "Yeah." "Like, when?" "Today." And he said, "Have you ever heard the expression of blank you money?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, that's what this is." That car is when you have enough blank you money, you don't care.
Yeah.
But you were going to talk about the 1 liter.
The 1 liter Volkswagen car.
Which, tell the viewers where that originated, because that's an interesting story.
Yeah, actually, Volkswagen showed a concept a number of years ago.
It's only 3 years ago.
3 years ago? Is that all? I mean, boy, does time fly.
Peach Rider? Was it 4 years ago?
I think it was 4 years ago, because I think Bernd Peschitzrieder, who used to run Volkswagen, has been gone that long.
Has he been gone 4 years?
I think he has.
I didn't think it was that long.
Is
he not serviced?
You know, I'm blanking out. No, he is someplace right now, but it's not with an automaker. And but anyway, yeah, they came out with this kind of funky-looking tandem seat, 1 liter car. 1 liter, of course, means it consumes 1 liter of fuel for every 100 kilometers, which turns out to...
And PX drove it on the Autobahn with Peschitzrieder in the back.
Peschitzrieder in the back, right.
To the board meeting.
Right.
And this was supposed to be PX swan song because he was retiring.
Right.
Little did Peschitzrieder know that the back seat was an ejector seat.
Right. And it was a cool little thing. I mean, readers need to understand, I make fun of PX a lot, but at one point when he was good, he was a brilliant engineer that worked on some of the finest Porsche racing cars ever.
The 917.
And 917. But his first one was the 908-3, right. My favorite. But then he got weird. He got weird. And
the power went to his mind.
Yeah, and he's just like this. He's almost diabolical. And that was supposed to be a swan song, the 1 liter. And then here they show up at the Frankfurt show with a production version almost.
Yeah, there's the original, which is very soft, very bulbous. It looks like something that came out of advanced research or advanced engineering. But the new one...
Sort of looks like the Frankenstein version of an EV1.
Well, we got an email from Jim Sawyer who says it looks like the Messerschmitts from the late 50s and early 60s, and it kind of does.
Yeah, and do we have the new one?
The new one is, I think, pretty modern-looking car. Here it is. I like that. Again, it's tandem seating. I don't think I'd ever go for tandem seating. I don't like that idea. But again,
like the Italian way where you have three seats...
Yeah.
You know, so you have in Italy, so you can have your wife and your mistress riding with you.
Right.
No, I remember they interviewed some designer and they said, "Well, yeah, of course."
Right.
And it was just like, "What? Excuse me?
What was that Pirelli ad? This goes way back. And it shows this guy driving, you know, straight arm back. It's a shot from above, and he's like in an Alfa or something like that. And he's got his other arm around his girlfriend with this low-cut dress, and it says, "If you told him to use both hands, you know where he'd put them." Not on the wheel, in other words. But, yeah, this 1 liter concept is pretty cool, although... I think if you look at the specs, it's actually a 1.5-liter car, not 1 liter, but still.
You know, this gets back to one of my favorite Gordon Murray designs, the Rocket, which was like basically a Formula.
Gordon Murray, of course, the guy who's been at McLaren forever and ever, brilliant designer.
Now off on his own, but he built this famous car called the Rocket, which was basically a Formula Ford for the street, but beautiful. And I've always been intrigued with light, agile sports cars. I mean, you drive around in England in the countryside, you see all these weird little contraptions, you know, home-built almost. And it's like a cottage. It is a cottage industry over there. But Gordon Murray did this Rocket. And, you know, those kinds of cars, I think, are really cool. Mm-hmm. Which when people say, oh, well, this all doom and gloom, where all the performance drivers, the enthusiasts are going to be left out in the cold, I don't think so.
Now, Cadillac's talking about a lot more V-series cars coming.
I mean, but I
every
mean,
company I talk to is talking about performance cars.
You know, if it really gets bad, you know, if it's gas is $5 a gallon, you know, we'll go, enthusiasts will get these small little high-performance two-seaters, and they'll crop up like, you know, weeds.
See, oh, you know, if they tax gas or whatever, then the performance cars will go away. What, they don't have AMG cars and M3s and M5s in Europe? They don't sell them over there?
No.
And look, a bunch of the environmentalists are going to be horrified when they see how fast we can make some of these electric cars go. It's like,
say, well,
it's going to be performance.
That's not the way it's supposed to be.
Right.
It's supposed to all be hugs and at the toll booth, and, you know, we all share our cars, and whatever.
Right.
There was something far more interesting than automobiles coming out of the Frankfurt Motor Show, though.
What?
That was Sergio Marchionne's comments.
Oh, God.
I blogged about this.
That.
I actually wrote a rather lengthy blog item when he said
they're going to sell 6 million cars?
No. Not even that. It was that they found some surprises at Chrysler, and he was...
It's going to be harder than he thought.
He was surprised how little had been done over the past couple of years, and I'm thinking... The first thing I thought was, oh, God, here we go. Is this the third straight buyer, in so much as Fiat really bought Chrysler, to not have done very good due diligence before getting into this thing, first of all? Second of all, how could you be surprised that nothing was done? I mean, you had Chainsaw Bob running the company. Yeah, I wrote my blog. He didn't take an axe to the thing. He took a high-powered chainsaw to it, you know, indiscriminately offering buyouts.
Or as I call them, minimum Bob.
Someone in purchasing told me that, you know, they were losing, so many people were taking the buyout in the purchasing department. And finally they went to Nardelli and said, we're losing too many people here. Should we, you know, basically cut it off and let other department? He goes, no, we'll find a way to get the work done. And suppliers were telling me that they would go to Chrysler on projects and just find whole areas empty, and people they were dealing with were just gone. Work couldn't get done, and there was a scramble to get things done. You know, and then Marchionne comes in and he goes, wow, we're surprised at, you know, how little work has been. Well, there's no product budget. You know, a bunch of the staff is out. Some whole departments lost too many people. They didn't do much advertising or marketing. Of course, nothing. It seems like nothing was done because, you know, very little was done. And, this is going to be harder to fix than you thought.
I don't think he's surprised at all. I think he's just setting everybody to say, this is going to be real hard to do, and here's my excuse. I was surprised.
But speaking of marketing, you know, the train wreck looming there in marketing, you know, they've got four divisions now.
Including Mopar.
Well, no, they've got Dodge Truck, Chrysler, and Jeep. They have four individuals running those.
Dodge Truck's being run differently?
It's being split. Been split.
What's Mike Accavitti doing? I thought he was running all of Dodge.
I don't... There's a distinction. And the reason I'm bringing this up is I found out that 10 agencies have been camped in hotels in Detroit in the last 2 weeks trying to get in on this pitch because they've thrown all of their advertising up for bid for the fourth quarter. I mean, talk about being late. But anyway, I've heard they've awarded four individual agencies the work, for one for each of these divisions. And it's just like, guys, it's chaos. I mean, they just don't have
them. So someone's going to get the Dodge car business?
Yeah, and someone's going to get the Dodge. And another agency's going to get Dodge Truck. Another agency's going to get Jeep. Another agency's going to get Chrysler. It's just like, guys, come on. You don't have that much money, number one. You don't have that many products. You think...
You're doing Dodge Car.
Why are you adding chaos to an already chaotic situation?
You're doing Dodge Car. You're advertising two cars.
Yeah, it was just like, you got to be kidding me.
Three with Viper.
I don't think...
hasn't really come out much yet, so that's kind of breaking news. But that's... that's a nightmare. And then the other thing, of course, he said, well, our unified company is going to sell 6 million.
Well, they're at 4 million now.
Yeah, Fiat sold 2.4 last year, and Chrysler...
Oh, remember Zetch's big proclamation. Oh. They were going to grow their Chrysler sales by, it was a million, right?
Yeah, and Chrysler sold 2 million, sort of, last year. And Sergio said, oh, we're going to sell 6 million, and I put on the website, in what decade?
You know, one year, I'm interviewing all these sales executives and CEOs at the auto show, and, you know, everybody, you know, Kurt Ritter was running Chevrolet at the time, 03 or 04, I think. It may have been further back than that. I can't remember how long Kurt's been gone. But, you know, he said, you know, Chevy's going to grow by like 500,000 units or something. And Mitsubishi says they're going to grow by like 350,000 units.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And So basically, you know, these were the first couple of interviews I had, and then I said, oh, this is great stuff. So I started going to everybody. So how much are you going to grow? Oh, you know, another 500,000. And then I would just, you know, added it all up.
So we're talking a 25 million unit year.
It literally was a market of like 21 or 22 million units that we had to get to for everybody to get their growth. And I asked Lutz about it at the end of this thing, and he just sort of, you know, kind of snickered a little bit because he's seen that movie before, and of course nobody's going to, you know, the market was actually started.
Well, the bad part is, the even worser part is that they build the capacity to meet those sales goals, and then they go, golly, we got so much excess capacity. And I think the same thing's going to hit China. Everyone's telling me, oh no, China, it's got a big market, it's going to grow. You watch it. They're going to have excess capacity in China.
Yeah, talk about a hangover. It's going to be.
Well, remember, before the economy, the global economy started to suffer, for the past few years, you've had growing sales in China, fast growing sales, and prices falling at the same time because so much capacity is coming online. It's not just the capacity either. It's also the addition of nameplates. I mean, when things are blowing and going, companies think they can do no wrong because everybody looks smart, and they start getting into segments where they're really not very good and, you know, adding. You know, so you're adding capital costs on top of all this capacity because you're making more vehicles, and then segments get flooded on top of the whole market being flooded.
The most frightening statistic I stumbled upon about China was it something like 1,000 brand new drivers a day?
Youch.
1,000 brand new drivers careening around China.
Well, that would lead me to prognosticate very optimistic sales, too.
But, yeah, but there's got to be a cliff somewhere along.
There will be. I guarantee you there will be. Hey, we got to get into rapid fire, but before we get into that, did you guys see this IIHS crash test? The Insurance Institute of Highway Safety crashed a 2009 Malibu into a 1959 Chevy Bel Air, just to show how much progress we've made. We ought to run that clip. And here we go. Check this out. Boom. And it's an offset. It's 40 miles an hour. Each one's going 40 miles an hour. And you'll see the Malibu, the front end, really crumples up. But the passenger compartment stays almost completely intact.
And the 59 folds
and the
up
59,
like an accordion.
Oh, my God.
Look at the door. Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Right. Now, again,
I mean, the front, the driver would just be
mangled.
Oh, well.
Well, there's no. Here, look at this. This is really. Watch the steering wheel in the 59. You can't see it that well in that shot. But there's no seatbelt, you know, which is kind of an unfair comparison from that standpoint.
Well,
but
dead,
here we go.
Dead.
Instant. Boom, right there.
Ugh. Oh, man.
Yeah, you're dead.
But now you got to see the new Malibu, because it almost looks like you could open the doors in the 2009. And you got to remember, too, a closing speed of 40 miles an hour of each car, that's
80.
Like you crashing into a car at 80 miles an hour that's
right.
parked.
Right.
Because people think, oh, 40's not that much. Believe me, it'll send a chill down your spine.
The funny thing is, people may not expect this because they think those old cars from the 50s were just big blocks of steel and they were indestructible tanks. And,
Well, they were for their day. I mean, you know, that was. You know, you wanted to be in a big boat back then.
Yeah.
But it was clearly not designed.
Well, it's also why, you know, getting back to, we have so much stuff in our cars now, and that's why they're the weight creep that we've talked about. And
the 2009 Malibu weighs roughly the same as that 59 Bel Air, which is a much longer car, certainly.
Yeah, yeah.
Much longer.
Wow, that's interesting.
It was very dramatic. And what was weird about it, too, is Craig Cole with us here found that online. And I said, well, you know, let's go to the IIHS site because I want to be able to cite, you know, them for not not a peep about it on their site. So I called them up and said, did you guys really do this? Is this just some Photoshop gig going on the line? They said, no, we absolutely did it. And I went, why isn't it on your site? Well, we're doing the analysis and we're trying to I thought, this is weird. Now, they have come out with the analysis. They're making all that available. They are going to put this on their website. But it was curious how they went to YouTube first and they didn't say peep about it. Kind of weird.
Quick before rapid fire, we were all very skeptical about the Ed Whitaker ads last week. I think he came off pretty well in these ads. I mean, I don't think it's going to win him a ton of buyers.
Well, he's only on it for a couple of weeks, and then he
goes
away.
But I thought
I thought Ed was fine.
Him in person, at a GM press event, and he seems straightforward and like a smart guy and all that. I was surprised how much better he came off in the ads after meeting him in person. Not that he was a drip or anything in person, but he just, he came off a lot more slick in these ads. And he does, he's got the whole Texas thing going on, vehicles, that it's very non-Detroit. I think they ended up doing a pretty nice job of it.
Well, I don't know. I saw them. It didn't do much for me. And all I thought was...
I don't think it's going to move the needle all that much. I think it does put a bit of a... I mean, it puts a better face on GM for sure, but I just don't think... It's not going to burnish the amount of rust that's on the GM name. And you don't sell cars at a GM dealership.
You can't expect it to work miracles in
three weeks.
But for what it's intended to accomplish...
I can see for some buyers who are already GM buyers who are thinking of bolting,
they will reassure
that this guy
them.
Comes out and says, hey, look, I was a skeptic. I'm an outsider. I think we got good stuff. Then they might say, okay, but I can't see somebody going, oh, well, forget Toyota. I'm going to go. I don't see that happening. And especially once you get below boomers, baby boomers in an age group, I don't see them being moved by this at all. I don't know. We'll see.
We'll see how the comparison ads do.
Right. Well, here we got our rapid-fire questions. Ben, run the graphic.
Tom Cruise with an AK-47.
I love that thing.
It is awesome.
Okay.
I don't know if David really knows who that is or if he really thinks it's Tom Cruise.
I have no idea who it is. I don't think it's Tom Cruise,
That's
though. I just think it looks like...
The late Jason Vines.
That's Vines?
With the wig?
See it again?
Yeah. Yeah.
With the
right.
wig?
Yeah.
Here we go.
I like the horror movie music, too.
Yeah, with manipulated mouth. That's funny. Jason's ears are ringing.
That's
now.
Great.
Okay, Pedro Fernandez asks, if you can buy a hybrid for around $24K and a Chinese all-electric for $20, why would you buy a 40K Volt? What advantage does it have over a hybrid to warrant the extra money?
Good question. I don't know that you're going to see the all-electric Chinese car for $20K, and frankly, I don't know that they're going to have the quality. I think people are going to be suspect on that. The hybrid's just not going to be as high fuel economy and as high tech as the Volt. You buy the Volt to make a really big tech statement that
it's a statement car, and it's also a first of the block car. But if you start comparing it to the typical hybrid, it's going to come up short because of the price.
Well, the price, although we know there's a whopping big federal credit on it.
$7,500 or something.
Right. So if you don't drive more than 40 miles, you can have an electric car. Don't use no imported oil.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the advantage.
Go to a chat room about the Prius, and you got people geeking out with the mileage they got. I mean, think about the people who are going to geek out with, well, I got 230 in my Volt. It's the difference between buying, something fast and zippy like a Mini Cooper S or, for $30,000 or, name another sports car that goes for $50,000 and it's that much faster.
Artemis77 has got a great question here. He says, if the government counted the new cars bought under cash for clunkers by drivetrain, and we had that big discussion, he says, how'd they count the used cars that were traded in for the new ones? And that is a dynamite question because they counted those trade-ins by model name, not by drivetrain.
Wow.
And that's Artemis77, that is a fantastic question. I hadn't thought of that at all until this was brought up.
You demand.
You demand, right.
With a tip of the hat to Artemis Gordon.
Hey, we got a phone call from Jeff about VW's 1-liter car. Ben, patch that call in, would you?
Hi, John. This is Jeff. What are the chances of the Volkswagen prototype, which is commonly known as the 1 liter car, which is now 2 liters, of making its way to our shores here and to the United States in 2013? And I know they can only make 1,000 of them a year, but I'm curious if any of them will ever make it to the United States.
Think about Volkswagen.
What's the next best alternative if you don't want a EV as far as...
Well, Volkswagen must have said 2013, but I'd be shocked if it ended up over here.
I would, too. I could only see maybe if they did it on a sort of boutique basis, yeah, to really create a buzz for the brand. I don't see those kinds of tandem seat, dinky little cars really catching on much. I mean, gasoline would have to get real expensive for that to happen. Let's see, who else here? Comment from Mudmonster37. I don't understand why some automakers have a bad case of introductus interruptus. Somebody read your column this week, Peter.
Yeah.
The Grand C-Max, for example, which is the Ford new minivan, will not be here until 2011. Why the wait?
Well, first of all,
explain introductus interruptus.
Well, that's one of my pet peeves, you know. It's like showing a car at an auto show and then re-showing it and reintroducing it. And then by the time the production car comes out, everyone's like, you know, we're over that. It's old.
Yeah, they haven't sold one and everyone feels
it's
like...
It's old news. Now, Ford did that with the Thunderbird. They introduced it at
three
straight Detroit shows. Then it finally came out like in July of that.
Don't forget, they had one at SEMA 1 year, a special edition.
Yeah.
And they had like the Neiman Marcus edition of it at Pebble Beach.
Yeah,
it was like five sort of big press events before they had anything on the market.
And then they went to bring it out and they had production issues. It was just a disaster. And what was the question again?
Well, with the... Interruptus, the C-Max.
I got a lot of flack from readers saying, well, way to go for taking the narrow Detroit view. You know, we can buy the C-Max next spring. I said, yeah, I get that. The problem is Ford talks about it here, you know, and, you know, it's 2 years away, and it just drives me nuts. Yeah, it's coming here. But Ford should just say, yeah, it should come to this market eventually, but not do a big press thing that's, you know, churning the airwaves here. It just bugs me, really.
I'm with you on that one. Okay, a comment from MetTech. I hope I'm saying that right. What's going to happen to the electric cars when they start making LG fuel?
You know,
if the LG works, and we'll preface everything by an if, but if the LG works...
That could change everything.
Everything.
A new muscle car era.
Yes. Yeah.
Well... Are we sure about that, though? Because you know, you're still talking about CO2, right?
It's
the whole thing to me.
Because remember, the focus of CAFE has been about purely about fuel economy. Now the government's focusing on more on CO2 than it has before. And even though biodiesel made out of LG it's not an imported oil source, and if it's biodiesel, it's more efficient. You're still talking about CO2, and let's figure
out. A fraction. I mean, because, yes, when you burn the LG fuel, it gives off CO2, but when the LG grows, it absorbs CO2, so it's what they call carbon neutral.
And I think.
Is it carbon neutral, or is it just carbon mitigating?
It's damn near carbon neutral. Now, you got to get into the refining process, which involves stuff, but so does refining any kind of other fuel, you know,
well,
especially petroleum.
It'll come down to. And people start to do some really good analytics on this. Hell, maybe I should do a story on it. And that is, you know, what's the carbon footprint for producing enough electricity for, say, 20% of the fleet to go to this versus the carbon footprint of, you know, 20% of the fleet being, you know, LG diesel or, you know, LG biofuels?
Well, remember, I mean...
That's what you're going to have to start
half
with.
Half the electricity in this country, more than half, is still done by coal. So your electric car isn't carbon-free either.
No, it isn't, and people forget that.
They forget it. And here's a great comment from PT that ties in with this. He says, I'm worried that these nice small cars from Europe will be a bust here and that the auto companies will be in bigger trouble.
This is a Ford gamble. You know, Ford's bringing their Euro cars over here, Fiesta and the European Focus, and they might be great cars. But
and, well, Chrysler's going to be bringing Fiat-type cars over
I
here.
I wrote about this a few weeks ago, and I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but if you look at the small car capacity that's going to be installed in this market in the next couple of years, you're going to need a pretty big run-up in compact and subcompact car sales for not to be a big discounting game on these cars. It's a tremendous gamble, even with CAFE, because Americans don't like compacts if they don't need to buy them.
Well, yeah, but I'll tell you what.
You need a gasoline.
Anybody who thinks we're going to hover around $2.65 a gallon for a long time
is dreaming.
Is kidding themselves. And
I don't know, didn't we just find 3 billion barrels in the Gulf of Mexico? Big BP oil find?
Yeah.
Jed, move away from there.
I'm not seeing gas as cheap.
We did, but that's
cheap,
as you know, in the grand scheme of things, 3 billion barrels of anything is a lot. But in the way that this country consumes oil, it doesn't last very long.
I was talking to Michael Sprague at Kia when I did that small car story, and he said, you know, they're looking at middle of next decade, $283 a gallon. Most oil experts I've talked to are looking at $80 a barrel, which still translates to under $3 a gallon. And Americans don't really shift big until you get into the high threes.
That's gambling on political stability. I'm not going to make that bet. I think we will see a spike again. And the next plateau, it won't fall back below 3 next time. It'll go up to 4, over 4, and then it'll drop down.
There's no question it's on a long-term.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
How do you plan for that?
And plus, Americans haven't been exposed to really great smaller cars. And once they do and they get behind the wheel, you know, they're great to drive, you know.
Okay, Mud Monster 37, another question. He wrote in to say, what do you think about Buick's new tagline, the new class of world class?
It's better than take a look at us, take a look at me now. But it's just okay. It's not great.
I kind of like it, the new class of world class. Now you just got to deliver with the product.
Yeah,
so it is world class.
Well, exactly, and that's where
it's better than what they had.
I'm in the minority with you guys, and this is the problem Buick's going to have is that, you know, they're claiming to be part, you know, of the new class of world class, and they have some good product, but it's not all there yet. You guys were talking last week,
about
standard of the world for Cadillac. I think it's a great tagline for Cadillac. I don't think they're going to be ready for that for a couple of years because you've got a great CTS, a really good SRX. The rest of the lineup just isn't there yet. And I think you're going to need a showroom full of cars that can compete with every other luxury car out there before you can make that claim. I don't think you can make the claim with just, you know, 2 good cars.
Well, no. What I was saying is they're probably never going to be able to prove that claim. But they need to put the stake in the ground and shoot for that, you know, because no matter
what. You can't do that too publicly, because then the public goes into your showroom and they see.
Oh, no, sure you can. Sure you can, because.
And they see an STS and a DTS.
Because there's always going to there's always going to be haters out there that never are going to buy Cadillac no matter what you do. But they own standard of the world. You still see people saying, well, it's the Cadillac of vacuum cleaners. And, you know, and so do it. Yeah, would there be 49% of the people out there that don't believe it? Sure. But at least they own it.
Right.
And no one else can own it. So that was my point. They got to do it and strive for it, even if people don't believe they're achieving it. Some people will.
Okay, we got another phone call coming in from Jeremy. Let's patch that in, Ben.
Hi, this is Jeremy Jones from Dallas, Texas. And I heard John say on a podcast this week that GM executives were to rent their own vehicles when traveling. Don't you think that's kind of counterintuitive? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Shouldn't they be driving competitors' vehicles? I know that I'm in the industry myself, and I always look for a competitor's vehicle so I can find out our strengths and weaknesses. So I'd love to hear your thoughts. Thanks for all the great work. Look forward to AutoLine After Hours every week, and take care.
That's cool, Jeremy. Yeah.
Are they going to rent? Are they just going to go to a rental agency and get potluck, you know, whatever key?
No, the new policy is that as a GM employee, you are supposed to ask for a GM product if you have to go rent
a
car.
That's a stupid idea. They should be renting
competitor products.
Yeah. Well, they should just take what they get, like most people do.
Yeah.
But I like Jeremy's idea. I think it's incredibly important to get in what the competition's doing. I am often amazed at how I will meet program managers, the people who run a vehicle product line who have not been in not just their competitors' products, they haven't even been in the direct products that they are competing against. Now, I think that's terrible. I think They should all, I think car companies should have no bones about buying competitors' products and making sure their people drive them.
In the 50s, Bill Mitchell used to get the latest Ferrari and park it in the courtyard of the design staff and let the design, not say anything, and just let the designers swarm all over it.
I also think rental car agency executives should have to go and stand in line like everybody else and then get in the dirty, crappy cars that are on their lots now and realize what a lousy experience it is to rent a car. I've had some bad
rental car. The other part of that GM travel policy is they can, the senior executives can fly business class. And then some TV station locally showed Fritz going through the security line at Metro like everybody else. It's just like a whole new world.
Well, you know, look, it makes a big difference when
He's done that for, when he lived in Florida.
Yeah, he commuted back and forth.
He commuted
on commercial.
Sure.
Right, right. But as you guys know, if you do a lot of flying, I mean, it makes a big difference to be able to be up front where you can spread out and do some work or maybe take a nap or something.
I don't have a problem with them flying business class.
I don't have a problem with them flying corporate jets. They aren't a hardware store.
Right.
You know, the whole thing with Washington still makes me furious because all those senators and congressmen either take guest rides on corporate jets from their contributors or Nancy Pelosi upgrades to a 757 because I don't want to stop for fuel going home to California. I mean, come on. They treated them like they shouldn't have a corporate jet. Bullshit.
That was a big smelly red herring, that whole thing.
Okay, Joseph wrote in to say, what about Rolls-Royce? Sales are down 41%, but they act like the new Ghost will save them, which the Ghost was just introduced at Frankfurt. He says, is there too much competition in that price range for Rolls to survive?
I think Rolls will survive. I mean, but the luxury, the whole luxury thing is suffering from overexposure. I mean, look at Lamborghini. Aren't their sales down like 60%?
Well, I think everybody's sales are down right now. But
they'll, you know, Rolls will always have a niche there.
Well, remember, BMW owns Rolls, and BMW has a lot of pride in the fact that it's got that. Rolls sold, I think, 12, or they're on track to sell 1,200 cars this year or something like that. I'm not sure they're making any money. And, you know, the question is, can they, not so much can they sell enough cars or whatever, but are they making any money at what they're doing?
Yeah, you know, having a ultra luxe brand like that in your portfolio for these, for the guys who run these companies, it's like owning a sports franchise or a big media publication. there's prestige and money in it.
Yeah, you know, Volkswagen has the Bentley thing.
I think Bentley, when things were going well, I think Bentley was making money because
They're down.
They moved down and they got higher volume.
Everybody's down. I think Rolls will survive.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, we'll make this the last question. We'll go back to Pedro Fernandez again, who asks, Toyota, are they doing the right thing by expanding the Prius line, or is it going to fall flat? I don't know if you guys heard that, you know, they're going to have, you know, Jim Lentz at Toyota has been pushing this idea for over a year now.
Oh, yeah.
I think he's really onto something.
They've been talking about a whole Prius brand, like sub-brand, for quite a while. I think it's a very good idea because you look at other companies with hybrids. You know, Ford, GM is probably the worst example of a company that has decent hybrid technology but can't sell it. The Honda Civic Hybrid, you know, none of these even are even in the same ball yard with the volume that the Prius does. So, you know, if you want to expand the hybrid line but set the brand apart and say, you know, this is real hybrid stuff, it's a great way to do it.
I think they're really onto something. I think it could go well for them.
I think, but I will cautionary.
Too many brands, maybe, with Scion.
You can't throw Prius on everything. I just have bad memories of when Oldsmobile threw Cutlass on everything.
Yeah, it became the Cutlass division.
And they ran it into the ground. But, yeah, they'll probably handle it right if they do it.
I mean, the Cutlass Calais isn't a classic.
Well, we ought to wrap it up. We're at the top of the hour here. But, David, great seeing you. Thanks for coming in again.
Always a pleasure.
Same with you, Peter.
Glad to be here, John.
Remember, everybody watching us, you can follow us at facebook.com/OutOfLineDetroit. Can follow us at twitter.com/OutOfLine. Follow Peter at AutoExtremist.com. Can also follow him at twitter.com/AutoExtremist. And you can follow David Welch at AutoBeat blog at businessweek.com.
Just businessweek.com, and then just you'll find the AutoBeat blog on the blog list.
And you're in there. Okay, cool. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in.
Visit our website, outofline.detroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there and much more at outofline.detroit.tv. Orange, purple, silver, and blue changes.